From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Like a lot of us, Robert Douglas Fairhurst first encountered the story of Alice in Wonderland as a kid, and he reacted in the same way the rest of us did. He was frightened at points, confused at others, but mostly just enchanted. When he grew up and became a scholar, he couldn't completely get the story out of his mind. He wanted to know why it worked like it did on him. In his new book, Douglas Fairhurst looks to find out how it was Lewis Carroll had managed to create something he remembered so intensely. He's joining us today to talk about Lewis Carroll and Alice, the real Alice and the one in the books, because that's a big part of the story behind the story of Wonderland, that blurry line between the actual and the possible. The story of Alice today, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book about the story behind the story of Alice in Wonderland, Robert Douglas Fairhurst describes Lewis Carroll, the man who improvised the story in a riverbank on July 4th of 1862, as someone who presented a lopsided appearance to the world. One of Carroll's eyes drooped, Douglas Fairhurst tells us. One shoulder was also slightly higher than the other, but there were other ways in which he could be lopsided, less a consistent personality than two strangers. He was, according to Douglas Fairhurst, both Lewis Carroll, an imaginative writer who wandered through life with a head full of stories, but also the Reverend Charles Dodgson, a plodding mathematician. Today in the program, we're talking about Lewis Carroll and the story behind the story of Alice in Wonderland. Carroll had a relationship with a young Alice Whittle that was suspicious by our standards today. Douglas Fairhurst puts that relationship in context, but of course there are other things to talk about too, white rabbits and mad hatters and dreams and puzzles. The book is called The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll and the Secret History of Wonderland, and you can join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Robert Douglas Fairhurst is a professor of English literature and a fellow of Magdalen College in Oxford. And he's joining us today from the BBC studios in Oxford. And Professor, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Doug. It's great to be here.
I wanted to begin with this photograph that you put right at the beginning of the book. It's a picture taken in 1832 of Alice P. Hargraves. She's, of course, the inspiration for Lewis Carroll's Alice. And I wanted to begin there because you tell about that story of first seeing that photograph. This was in the fall of 2013, and you mentioned in the book that you were kind of casting about for material that would help you make sense of Lewis Carroll's life, and that photo seemed important. Would you talk about that?
Yes, it was important, and it's largely because what you see when you look at the photograph is quite an old woman, and yet in the background you see the fictional creation Alice, who's been painted on a screen, and it's like one of those Victorian puzzles or jokes where you're expected to think about the transformation of one thing into another thing, because it's only a little later that you realize that the real person you're looking at was indeed Alice Liddell, the original Alice in Wonderland. And even little clues are given to us, like the fact that she's wearing a version of an Alice band, which by then had become a popular fashion accessory. So it's as if the person taking the photograph, and that was in New York in 1932, where she'd come to receive an honorary degree from Columbia University. It's as if we were being asked to think about what you said in your opening remarks, is that blurry line between the actual and the possible.
It's interesting that you say also this, you were trying to make sense of Lewis Carroll's life, but also of your own on some level, because you mentioned how you first read the Alice books as a young child, and you had the same kinds of feelings, as I mentioned in the introduction, that all of us did. You know, you call it an emotional scramble, which is, I think, just right. But you say that the idea of the story, or the impact, I guess, of the story, didn't really ever go away, and you kind of wanted to explain, I guess, why that was?
Yes, that's right. And I suppose that's partly because even if we're not talking about the Alice books, we use them to talk with. So they're so much a part of everyday conversation and the way we view the world. If you talk about somebody chortling or galumphing, if you say curiouser or curiouser, or you hear somebody jokingly saying off with his head, you know, it suggests that these books have somehow infiltrated our collective consciousness. And Wonderland has become a way we use to gloss the world around us. So that was one strand. And the other strand, I suppose, was that in 2002, I came to a new job in Oxford, which is where Lewis Carroll spent almost all of his adult life. And Oxford, to an outsider, as I was then, is a mad place. When you're on the inside, it's more of a maddening place, right. But it's full of strange rules and quirky bits of ritual and real places that you realise later were brought into the Alice books, like a treacle well, treacle being a medieval English word for medicine, and it's a real place in Binsey, just outside Oxford, where the Alice and her sisters used to be taken. So when you put all those bits of the jigsaw puzzle together, I suppose it was for me a little bit like coming home, but it wasn't coming home to a place I knew. It was coming home to a very strange version of my own childhood. And that's why I wanted to grapple with the stories and try and work out how they came to be written and why they still have such a huge impact on our culture.
We'll get back to the particulars of this idea of double identity, but it seems like such a theme. And I guess it's not surprising, Lewis Carroll and Charles Dodgson, that clearly is a kind of a double identity going on. That seems obvious. I guess the Alice part surprised me. The Alice Little, of course, and then the Alice in the story. There's also an identity there, a sort of a double sensibility there too. And that does seem like a theme, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. And I mean, when you go through the Alice books, you realize how much they are based around the idea of two things going into one. You know, puns, portmanteau words, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, even names like Humpty Dumpty, which of course he doesn't originate, but he takes up and plays with. It's as if Carroll was interested in that idea of how easily things could be spun or twisted or turned upside down or inside out. And you see that not only in his writing, you see it in his interest in photography. Mm-hmm. Because when you take a photographic negative, using the process he used, black is white is black. Left is right, right is left. You create an entirely reversed world. And that's something he never got rid of, if you like, from his imagination, even to the extent of individual words. Later on, in one of his other books, he pointed out that evil is simply the word live the wrong way round. And that's the kind of verbal game that he loved, that idea that you could turn the world upside down and inside out just with a little twist of logic.
The idea of identity is interesting. The Cheshire Cat asks Alice, "Who are you?" And she says, "I hardly know at the present." That seems important, I think, in the scheme of sense of identity, I suppose, too.
It is. And of course, during the books, she has good reasons to doubt who she is. She is at various points mistaken for a serpent and a monster and a housemaid. You know, she grows as tall as a tree. She shrinks to the size of a mouse. You know, she shows us that one person has the potential to be many different things. And that, of course, was something which Carroll and his contemporaries were interested in. This is the world that also brought forth Jekyll and Hyde, for instance. But it also says something particular and peculiar, I think, about Carroll himself as a man and as a writer. This love of doubleness and the insecurity of things that he found most important, as if, like one of his own word games, he couldn't think about how precious something was without making it also precarious.
Did you trust his diaries? I mean, I often wondered if his private thoughts he actually wrote down. I mean, he must have known people would be going through them at some point. And it did really make you wonder. I mean, you write about, for example, the fact that in public he had I don't know if sanctimonious is the proper way of putting it, but he certainly could seem a prude. If you think about his taste in theater, for example, which you write about later in the book. But he also had a kind of public religious persona, but then he, as you say, devoured supernatural books in private. So how much do you figure you actually got by looking at the diaries? I mean, how much was he obscuring, if you get my
name? That's a really good question. I think that, like a lot of people who write diaries, he saw them not as a way to explore himself, or to reveal himself to himself. It was a way to construct himself, or an idealized version of himself. What he saw when he looked at his diaries was a flattering or idealizing mirror of the person he wanted to be, who was logical and orderly and good. And in other words, what you don't get from the diaries is any sense of confession, except for a few blurted prayers where he talks about being bad. But given that he seems to have had very little sense of proportion or discrimination when it came to what was good or bad in his own conduct, it's very hard to know whether that is an unwitting confession of deep, dark desires, or whether it's just that, he didn't tip his bedder enough that morning. It's hard to know.
I suppose most of us know the story by now, because you've pointed out it's almost as famous as the Wonderland story itself. That is the story behind the story. But let's talk a little bit about that, and we'll come back to it. This is July 4th, as I mentioned, 1862. Alice and two of her sisters, they go boating. They go boating up the Thames, which I think is interesting. I hadn't really thought about this with Lewis Carroll and his colleague Robinson Duckworth up the Thames. That was quite a trick. These guys were in decent shape.
They were in very good shape. I mean, I've done the trip myself, and I'm not sure I could row there and row back in one day. I think it would kill me. And that's the other thing, that we tend to think of Carroll as an old, or at least older, man. But in 1862, he was 30. He was a young Don. And Robinson Duckworth, too, was a young Don. And one of the reasons why I think they enjoyed taking the girls out on these expeditions is that it was a way of having fun without consequences. And by that I mean that it would have been seen as entirely and wholly innocent then to have taken little girls out on a rowing expedition and to have told them stories and to have fed them a picnic, whereas taking older, unchaperoned girls out would have been seen as, it would have created all sorts of flurries of gossip around Oxford. So it was an opportunity to tell a story. And the interesting thing is, he didn't know what story he was going to tell them.
Right. I want to come back to that later in the program, because you say as he looked around at his surroundings, he could have gone in any number of directions. And the fact that he went where he went is telling. And it tells us a lot about Wonderland, I think. But I guess, did he just go off the cuff? He wrote this essay in 1887 where he mentioned how many of his stories and many of his fairy tales were never got written down. In fact, and I love this, which is an allusion he borrows from Keats, they lived and died, these fairy tales he's mentioning, like summer midges.
Yes, that's right. And Alice Liddell herself said that Mr. Dodgson, as she always scrupulously called him, Mr. Dodgson told us many, many stories before that famous summer afternoon, but they ended up in the waste paper bin. So that suggests that the way he told stories often was to improvise, and it was to draw sketches, and it was sometimes to draw on fragments of things he'd written earlier. For instance, the family magazines he pieced together when he was a child, which were these homemade miscellanies of sketches and stories and skits and illustrations and so on. And if you look at the final version of the Alice story, as it was published in 1865, you see there are little fragments which he's borrowed from some of his childhood writings, as if it was a way for him to keep in touch with his own childhood. So the mouse's tail, which we all know snakes down the page, gradually fading away to nothing. That is the same joke he'd used when he had written about the long and sad tail of a dog when he was much, much, much younger. And of course, what we don't know is how much of the story as we now know it was indeed told on that afternoon, whether it was just a series of funny jokes and songs, or whether it was a full-blown story. Mm. Because the first version, which he then wrote down, was only half the length of the one as we know it.
Yeah.
And that was the one he called Alice's Adventures Underground.
Well, Alice herself said not that nearly all of it was told that day, but I don't imagine you can trust her memory of that moment. It seemed a little sketchy.
I think you can't trust anyone's memories of that afternoon. I mean, the fact that everyone talked about it as a golden afternoon, but the weather report said that it was overcast and not very warm. I mean, it suggests that what people were doing, they were creating a little miniature golden age for themselves, version of childhood and of Victorian Oxford and of innocence, which you could put inside a little chronological bubble and protect it as they got older.
Robert Douglas Fairhurst is with us. His book is The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll, and the Secret History of Wonderland. And we'll get back to the story when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the story behind the story of Alice in Wonderland. Lewis Carroll first published Alice's Adventures 150 years ago. And we're talking to the Oxford professor Robert Douglas Fairhurst today about his new book, The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll and the Secret History of Wonderland. I wanted to ask you, Professor, it's interesting, I've just read the subtitle there, Lewis Carroll. You refer to it in the book, to him as Carroll, we're talking about that now. I guess you could have gone with Dodgson. Why Carroll?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think any biographer of this man has to work out how to address him. Some go for Dodgson. I know Morton Cohen went for Charles as an even more familiar way of thinking about him as a friendly presence in his own life. I went for Carroll because, in fact, it's not Dodgson, the theologian and logician and mathematician, who interests me. I think that his work there was something he devoted his large parts of his life to, but it seems not to have been especially significant to most people. It is his alter ego, his superhero style kind of extra identity he created for himself that I think has lasted. And that was a very conscious decision on his own part, to create this extra sort of supernumerary personality for himself, purely out of paper and ink, which is why he would write letters signed Lewis Carroll. But if anyone pointed him out as Lewis Carroll, as a physical human presence, he got very prickly and defensive and angry and said at one point, "There is one thing I hate, and that is to be pointed out as, there's the man who wrote Alice in Wonderland," as if somehow Lewis Carroll only existed in a world of words.
What was that about? I mean, it seems like this idea of wanting to be in control was important to him. And you tell this story in the book of how Carroll saw stories as this escape from the real world for sure, but that there were these limits, that he believed the imagination had to give way to, and here's how he put it, the principle of submission to discipline.
Yes, that's right. Well, he also talks in another letter about an absolute distinction between right and wrong.
Yeah.
And that's something which mathematics gave him, and it's something which religion gave him, because Dodgson, or Carroll, but in this case Dodgson, was not the kind of man to push at the limits of his religious belief, except by entertaining the world of the paranormal by reading about it. But he certainly wasn't the kind to go off and join a coven or conduct seances. What writing gave him, I think, was an opportunity to push those ideas to the limits, to discover where those limits were. And that's one of the ways of thinking about the Alice books, that they are something like the flip side of logic or mathematical precision on holiday. They are ways of turning the rules that he needed in his own life into subversions or parodies of themselves, almost as if he needed to test or even come close to breaking those rules in order to reaffirm their importance.
I mentioned your reference to him being lopsided. He could be gregarious and warm, but he could also be cold and prickly. He seemed pious to some, and others thought he was fairly bawdy. Kept toys and gadgets, but also wrote a lot of letters of pretty petty complaints to people, too. And you say, in fact, almost nothing in his life is capable of being interpreted in just a single way.
Yes. I mean, he was like one of the reasons that he was attracted to figures like Tweedledum and Tweedledee, who are always squabbling and yet require each other, was, I think, that is also true of the two personalities who inhabited his own skin, Carol and Dodgson. They also needed each other. They couldn't live without each other. But at the same time, in some ways, their collaboration was more of a quarrel. And that's what the Alice books are. They are this conversation which is always on the point of toppling over into a quarrel between the person who believes in logic and order, who is Alice, and the person who is desperate for fun and nonsense, who is also Alice.
Lewis Carroll was born in 1832. Big family. 10 siblings, even for the time, that was big.
Yeah, seven sisters, which sounds like the stars of a musical, doesn't it?
It does.
but actually wasn't. Yeah.
Seems like a pretty happy childhood, I have to say, though there's not much to go on in this part of his life anyway. You describe it as this happy blank. But I guess it was surprising on some level. I mean, he was bullied at school like a lot were. But it seems like for a person who seems to have a kind of, I don't know if obsession is the right word, but certainly thought a lot about the idea of childhood. You would think that his childhood would have been wanting.
Well, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. I would say that because we have so little information about his childhood, it's one that he could construct retrospectively in any way he wanted. And even if his own childhood was not perfect, that might be how he remembered it, perhaps because he needed to. It's worth noting how many of his siblings stammered or had some kind of speech impediment, for instance. It's worth noting his father seems to have been a rather domineering figure. Is there a relationship between those things? I don't know, although some psychologists have speculated there may have been. But certainly one thing that does seem to have happened is that when he grew up, retrospectively, he cast the garden in his childhood home in Croft-on-Tees into this enchanted bubble where children would always be children and the world would always stay still for them to play and to express themselves in fun and games. And one of the things that happened when I visited there, I stayed there for a couple of days with the current owners very, very kindly invited me to stay. You see traces of him everywhere. It's as if he couldn't leave it behind. He needed to leave little fingerprints of himself. So, for instance, he carved his initials in a couple of the windows, and they're still there. He buried little fragments of his childhood in a box under the floorboard of the nursery.
Right.
An interesting choice of room, the nursery,
which
included little bits of what then would then become the story of Alice in Wonderland, such as a glove counters for games and all sorts of little bits and pieces that then make their way into the stories, a thimble.
Yeah. Well, you referenced the character in Bleak House, for example, Dickens' book, where she puts aside the artifacts of her childhood. Carol never does. He keeps those gadgets. He keeps those things.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the like a lot of theologians at the time, he would have known the Bible with perhaps more intimacy than he knew most of his family and certainly more of most of his friends. And that injunction to put away childish things, usually we think of as meaning abandon them, relinquish them. In his case, he seems to have put them away for safekeeping. He put them away in a place where he would always have access to them. And it's another reason why perhaps he was so interested in writing stories, creating stories for children. It was a way of remaining in touch with whether a real or a fictitious version of his own childhood.
Croft-on-Tees, where he grew up, the idea of the word tease, did he make a play on that? Was he a teasing fellow?
Yes, he did. I mean, there's an early poem which he writes to his brother in which he says, "I'll show him the meaning of tease."
Right.
And one of the things that teasing allows you to do is both say something and unsay it simultaneously, doesn't it? It allows you to hint at a revelation, but then to withdraw from it. And that's something that Carroll became extremely good at doing in ways which haven't always been to his benefit when it comes to some of his letters addressed to the mothers of children about wanting to take photographs of them naked, for instance, later in his life, or indeed letters to the children themselves in which he seems to be using what could be either a flirtatious way of writing or perhaps just a teasing way of writing, as if he is alluding to a world of adult romance, which both of them know he's not serious about.
Well, that sort of gets us to that question that always seems to float to the top, and probably should, I suppose, is how you explain in context Carroll's relationship to children and to Alice in particular. But before we get to the particulars, what do you make of that question itself? Or do you think, I mean, because, you know, whether we're raising that question in the proper context, I'm sure it comes up all the time for you as you're talking about the subject.
Yes, it does. It does. I mean, I suppose in the same way that the Alice books over the last 150 years have become like one of those carnival mirrors which reflect distorted versions of present reality back at us. So we've used them to think about everything from the suffragette movement through to the First World War, through to the rise of science, and then in the 1960s, of course, drug culture.
Right.
And more recently, you know, the internet culture.
Of course.
The idea that everyone now, almost everyone, has a little rabbit hole they carry around with them in their pockets,
right,
in the form of a smartphone screen. But in just that same way, Carroll himself has been used as a distorting mirror that reflects all our fears or anxieties or hopes about ourselves. So it's in the 1920s that people start being nervous about his relationship with children. And of course, that reflects the rise of Freudian analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Most recently that people have assumed that he is, in modern parlance, a paedophile.
Right.
And that, of course, says quite a lot about our own anxieties, about the way that we too, like the Victorians, both sentimentalize and sexualize children. As for his own sexual identity, the problem that we have in trying to identify it is that we don't have a word. The word paedophile hadn't been invented when he was alive. His own sexual interest, if he had any, seemed to have been displaced into creativity of various kinds and into mathematics. And in some ways, the most honest way of thinking about him would be to say that although he was very good at making up puzzles, the most interesting puzzle he never managed to solve was himself.
Yeah. You don't actually come to a conclusion about the question of whether he was a paedophile in the book, but you seem skeptical.
Is that fair to say? Yes,
I
think it is fair to say. I think that, I mean, what I end up saying is that his deepest feelings seem to have been sentimental rather than sexual.
Mm.
At the time, there were some rumours that he might have been gay, although that too didn't yet have a word that was commonly attached to it. And that may be true. It may be that because his job required him not to marry, if he was going to keep his fellowship, by the time they changed the rules, he was so used to repressing or displacing sexuality that it seemed either pointless or impossible to think about it in any other way. His feelings for children, that is a very, very thorny issue.
Yeah.
It's a very thorny issue. And that's partly because the Victorians' understanding of what a child was, that was on the move too.
Right.
We think of it as a very firm and fixed category now, don't we, in which you are a child until you are either 16 or 18, and then you're an adult. The age of consent was shifting through the 19th century. It was 12 at the time that he first told the story to Alice and her sisters.
Shifted to 13, didn't it?
It's not until a scandal about child prostitution in 1885 that it's finally raised to 16.
Right. So
that suggests that what we think of as a firm and fixed category was quite blurry in the period. You see that in legislation, but you also see it in the way that children are, on the one hand, being elevated as little icons of innocence and purity, which is the rather sentimentalizing version that Carol preferred. And, of course, they're being used as prostitutes who don't carry venereal disease.
Right.
It's another kind of doubleness that he seems to have tried very hard to negotiate in, for instance, his photographs. Mm.
I heard a terrific BBC program with you talking about Carol, and it featured the scholar, the Dame Gillian Beer. And I liked what she said, because she says the story itself of Wonderland, the character of Alice in the story, is decent evidence anyway that Carol wasn't a child predator, that she was, Alice was smart and independent and free-thinking. Do you go along with that?
Yes, no, I do go along with that absolutely. And it's interesting that although the photographs that Carol took of children inevitably objectify them, or at least see them from a distance.
You write that he actually positioned them almost like mounted specimens.
That's right, or at least like lay figures, as they were called, these mannequins, and he was very interested in dolls. And yes, I mean that is all kind of a little odd. But in the Alice story, we see things from the outside, through the eyes of a narrator, and we see things from her perspective, through her eyes. It's a way of allowing us to rehearse or to get back in touch with what it is to see the world through the eyes of a child. And that is not the way that many paedophiles would understand children. That idea of empathizing rather than just seeing them from the outside as objects to be used.
Do we really know how they actually met? I mean, you mentioned that there are a lot of facts out there, but you can kind of arrange them in different sort of patterns.
Mm.
I think that you say in the book that he may have first seen Alice and her sisters through the window of the library there.
Yes, I think that's likely, because and again, I've been to the library. I've seen his room, and there is a very, very good view down into the deanery garden, which is almost the same size and the same style and the same age as the garden that he'd left behind in Croft-on-Tees. So to see little girls playing, for him, that window he was looking through would have been more like a time tunnel. It would have been a way of refracting his own memories of the time when he was the older brother with his seven sisters, and he was the one who was telling them stories and telling jokes and playing games. And then it allowed him to, in a way, to recapture that youth. Although this time, of course, he was even more in charge. And it's interesting that when other girls threatens his social dominance, really. He was very quick to assert his authority, you know, ripping up caricatures that they'd done of him, or being very angry if they seemed to be not treating him with the respect that he thought he deserved. And that suggests, again, another kind of doubleness, that he wanted to be as innocent as a child, but he also wanted the authority and the respect that comes with adulthood.
Robert Douglas Fairhurst is with us. We're talking about his book, The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll, and the Secret History of Wonderland. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Professor Robert Douglas Fairhurst. We're talking about his book, The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll and The Secret History of Wonderland. Well, let's come back to July 4th of 1862. Lewis Carroll settles in to tell this story. And I guess I'm imagining him in white flannels and a straw boater hat, which you say he liked to wear. He would have, mm-hmm. Dressed up for the excursion, I suppose. They did in those days.
That sounds about right, yep.
Yeah. And you write that Carroll, as we were talking about just briefly before, he could have chosen from any number of different scenarios in front of him. There was water there, of course, and so there could have been river creatures, there could have been all kinds of things, but he goes for the rabbit hole. Why does he choose that one? Do you have any idea?
Nobody knows. That's what's so interesting about it. It was a, if not a leap in the dark, it was a tumble in the dark for him as well as for her. yes, you're right. I mean, he could have thrown her into the water, metaphorically speaking, made her into a water baby, because it was only a couple of months later that the water babies would start being serialized. He could have imagined those strange half-child, half-adult, and I'm going to give you another half-animal creatures you get in The Wind in the Willows, right, who again live on a riverbank. But no, he sent her down the rabbit hole. I think just because they were there.
Right.
You know, that if you go to Godstow, if you do have a picnic on the bank, and again I've done this, it's very hard to miss the rabbits. They're everywhere.
The original name for the story was Alice's Adventures Underground, and you say that few literary environments were as crowded as the underground.
That's right. And that's partly because of the classics. You think about Virgil with trips to the underworld. You think about Dante. But more recently as well, there have been some attempts, not just in fairy tales, but in stories for children where characters adventured underground. A little bit later, Jules Verne would send his adventurers to the center of the earth. It was physically and also, I suppose, imaginatively crowded. And it's just before the first underground line opens in London. And in fact, the very day that he tells the story, the Times newspaper had a report about the sewer flooding one of the tunnels.
Right.
So the idea that you might drown or there might be dangers underground was something that was, if not in the air, then certainly in the news.
I guess if you were to sort of take this to its logical conclusion, it doesn't make any sense that underground there would be flowers and there would be sunny days and things like that. But I guess it wasn't I don't know, it wasn't really a place as much as a state of mind, Wonderland?
That's absolutely right. It's only towards the end that we realise that the whole thing is based on a pun. Carol loved puns, yeah. And we realise at the end that it's not that Alice is falling. No, she's falling asleep.
Right.
She's falling asleep. And therefore, what we get is a crazy jigsaw puzzle of bits of her waking life, such as school book lessons and bits of stories she's read, like Humpty Dumpty later on, and games from the deanery garden, and mysterious pets and adults who are as, you know, alarming as ogres from fairy tales. You know, what he does, all those fragments of her waking life that are rattling around inside her head, he pieces them together into a different kind of story. So in other words, it's like a guided tour of a girl's imagination when she's unconscious.
Yeah.
It's almost as if what he wanted to do was what people often talk about doing but very rarely do, which is he wanted to write like a dream. And usually when we say someone likes to write like a dream, we just mean, you know, they write beautifully.
Yeah.
But in his case, no, he really wanted to write like a dream. Yeah.
You point out we never are really told when she falls asleep. And it's that going back and forth. And I guess that's like a dream, right? Where we're sort of conscious, but we're not entirely. I mean, there's that moment where she's attacked by a pack of cards and then she wakes up and it turns out, in fact, to be leaves falling on her face.
Yes.
You know, vagueness and vividness, those two elements of a dream, I guess.
That's right. And that's something which a number of Carroll's contemporaries were interested in. This is one of the great ages of dream theory, where people are trying to work out what it is that influences how we dream and whether it's possible to control how you might dream. And also whether it's possible to turn a dream into a story, given that dreams don't depend upon logical connections, and they certainly don't work in sentences. So that kind of slipperiness of a dream, that kind of intangible quality that slips away when you try and grab it, like a handful of dust or water, that's the kind of thing that his contemporaries were interested in. And that's what he was trying to capture.
I wonder if, you know, how you were always puzzling over why this story was so intensely vivid to you, even later in your life when you had sort of put it aside. Do you think that's part of it, that in some way there's something, I don't want to make too much of this, but something in our subconscious that where a dream makes sense is connecting now in some way with Carol's story of Wonderland? Am I going too far there?
No. I think there probably is something there. And it's also, of course, one of the stories that we know before we know how to read.
Yeah.
It's one of those stories that's always there. And that means that our memories of it are so closely bound up with our memories of other things which are pre-verbal. And because a dream is a non-verbal experience, you can try and put it into words, but it doesn't itself involve words. That means that it can be a very powerful way of thinking about those experiences before you learn to read.
It's interesting how many people try and explain what's going on in Wonderland and try to assign characters to the people in Carol's life or in Alice's life. But it seems like you've kind of worked this out, and it turns out, you say, to kind of be impossible, because nobody in the story is straightforwardly singular, is how you put it.
Yeah. I think that's right. Yes, people want there to be a key,
yeah,
a key to the lock, don't they? They want to be like Alice when she's looking through the door into Wonderland. They want to find that key, as if somehow that will magic away doubts and uncertainties. But the point about Wonderland, it is a place of doubt and uncertainty. That's what makes it Wonderland. It's a place where you aren't just filled with wonder, you are made to wonder in the sense of question. And allow yourself to be suspended between different possibilities. So I think to try and solve the story is in fact to go against the point of the story, or indeed how the story works on us.
A lot of legends and myths and different ideas associated with Lewis Carroll and how he came up with Wonderland. And I wanted to get this out of the way, the idea that, and you hear this a lot, that Wonderland was just a reflection of a drug trip, that somehow he had been using psychedelics. You don't think much of that. At least there's no evidence of it anyway.
Well, no, there isn't. I mean, the only evidence, I suppose, would be that if you went to an everyday druggist chemist in mid-Victorian Britain, you would find an awful lot of medicines on open sale, which were based on heroin, I suppose, or opium, at least. And tincture of opium was, you know, a very popular sleeping drug, and that would produce certain kind of vivid dreams. But there's no evidence he used it. I mean, a lot of this has less to do with him than it does to do with what's happened to the stories over the last 150 years. A lot of people who grow up with the Disney cartoon, or grow up with some of the music that's been made based on the stories, especially the Jefferson Airplane song White Rabbit, you know, Feed Your Head and all that, or even the Beatles, you know, Picture Yourself in a Boat on a River is the beginning of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which a lot of people think, perhaps rightly, perhaps not, is a song about LSD. I'm the Walrus. I mean, wherever you look, there are now little fragments which associate the Alice books with drug culture. But those are associations we've made, other than the fact that there is a caterpillar sitting on top of a huge mushroom. And in fact, huge mushrooms had also been used in other stories before that. There's nothing, as it were, intrinsic to the story that makes it about drugs, although drugs might be about it.
Which kind of brings us to that other really important strand of the book that I wanted to ask you about, and that is the influence that the fictional Alice had on the wider cultural landscape, because it's pretty profound.
Yeah, hugely profound. Earlier I said that one of the ways of thinking about the books would be that they've been like a carnival mirror that reflect distorted versions of whichever culture is looking at them. Another way of thinking about them would be they're like those ink blot tests mm-hmm. that psychologists used to like using. That what we see in that ink blot, in that story, is a way in which we can think about ourselves and indeed the story of ourselves, how we have come to be who we are, both as individuals and as a culture. And that's why in 1901, just as I suppose modernism is starting to slowly crank its way into gear, one of the late obituaries for Carol ended by saying, "We are all Alice's, more or less. We are all Alice." Because these are stories about growing up, about change, about uncertainty. And therefore, they've become a very good way for us to think about all those other things that we don't quite understand, such as politics and the law and the future.
One interesting influence you point out early in the book is the impact, a possible impact anyway, on the American scholar of mythology, Joseph Campbell, and his exploration, you know, of mythology and hero stories and this idea of a call to adventure, which is absolutely what Alice was going through.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't think that Luke Skywalker and Alice have got a huge amount in common. And yet, right. And yet, you know, apparently George Lucas said that that book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, was a big influence on the Star Wars films. And I think, yes, the fact that it's a heroine who has now got at least 1,000 faces, and probably more than that because of internet culture, you do see that lurking behind this interest in comparative mythology.
We didn't have much time to talk about Alice's relationship with Carol. Conflicted, I guess, is the way to put it in some way. It's interesting she names her own son Carol, spelled differently, but that seemed interesting, maybe odd.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? I mean, she always said that it was a character she found in a book, but no one has ever found the book.
Right.
But the sheer fact that it was a literary relationship is interesting. And it might be, of course, that too was either something to throw people off the scent or she herself didn't know. Perhaps it too was a little prompting of her unconscious, a little nod to her own childhood, a way of keeping in touch with something which, as she grew up and became increasingly grand and distant and rather chilly as an adult, perhaps there was a little fragment inside her that she still wanted to hang on to.
You write about the last time he saw her. He invited her for tea. This was in September, I think, 1891.
That's right.
I don't think she actually came over for tea. She came over, but she couldn't spend too much time, and I didn't know what to make of that. Was she reluctant to spend time with him at that point?
It's very interesting, isn't it? Yeah. And again, it's one of those blanks in the story you can read in any way you want. Either she'd become a kind of entirely self-sufficient adult, and therefore he had done his job, mm-hmm. because that's one of the things that children's stories are supposed to do. They're supposed to educate children into the ways of the world and help them to become grown-ups. Or there was a nasty taste there, a nasty memory. She didn't want to spend time with him. She found him unsettling and creepy. You know, either of those are possible ways of reading the situation. What is interesting is that he writes up quite a full account in his diary in very precise, neutral, measured language. She doesn't mention it at all. Mm. Her diary for that day, her appointments diary, is a complete blank.
I was so fascinated, too, by the fact that later in his life, a man who could be decidedly unsentimental becomes really sentimental about Alice. And he publishes this essay, Alice on the Stage, I think it was called, where he's just crazy sentimental. In fact, it's so funny because you say you think that something had badly corroded his intelligence.
Yeah, I find it very hard to read. And I think it does have something to do with the fact that he was no longer writing for or about a real child. Mm. He was writing for and about childhood. And it's very, very hard to write about childhood without it seeming somehow out of touch with the reality of how real children behave, which, as anyone who has children or has met a child will know, isn't necessarily all sweetness and light. And the more he writes about childhood, the less he seems to be aware of how children really behave.
You write, you say that there are these kind of twin drives at play in Carol's life. On one hand, there is this idea of tradition. And then on the other hand, there's novelty. And they always were kind of driving him. And you say that it was the traditional side, which I guess is not surprising, but that asserted itself in his final years.
Yes, it did. And I think that being in Oxford didn't help. And I say that with I say that with a degree of self-consciousness. But now that term, and for me, has just come to an end. And of course, I'm thinking about the start of the next term and the next year. And you realize there will be new, well, not children, but young people coming, and they will stay for 3 years, and then they will go away, and then more people will come. And you realize that it's like a hamster bit on a wheel. Yes, that in some ways they never grow up. They do, of course, they grow up and leave individually, but as a body, as a group, you're stuck in the cycle. And I think that was one of the problems that Carroll perhaps had. He needed that idea of security, of children always being the same, hence the photographs and the stories and the academic year. But at the same time, it meant that increasingly, as he got older, he got more and more distant from the things that had inspired him in the first place.
Well, this is why I find this a profoundly sad sentence. You write that this is why the Alice books could never be written now. Because, and this is now Carroll writing, the sleepy afternoon air, the quaint grace, and the mock dignity are all the property of an elder and vanishing world. That seems really sad to me.
I think it is sad. And it's one of the reasons why the Alice books, for us, are not just fascinating because they've come to reflect on us and our own world, they're also a window into a world that has been lost. And it's not quite Wonderland, but Victorian Oxford, that Victorian world, is one which we have lots of different windows onto, just as Carroll had that real window onto the Deanery Garden, but we will never be able to inhabit it. And so in some ways, for me, as someone who's interested in that world, I feel a bit like Alice. When she has that little door into Wonderland and she can't squeeze through it. All she can see is that world beyond, which she will never have, she thinks, full access to.
It's Robert Douglas Fairhurst, Professor of English Literature at Magdalen College, Oxford. His book is called The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll and the Secret History of Wonderland. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in Oxford. Professor, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you very much, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. I'll mention today on Video West, we're premiering a new short documentary. It's a portrait of the artist Jean-Michel Aragona. He runs a shop in a small Midvale strip mall, and as you walk in the door, you wouldn't expect the sort of cabinet of natural curiosities that are contained inside. The film is called Perfect Little Machines. Go see it at videowest.kuer.org. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.